Our second to the last speaker is Claudia Chaffin. She received a medical degree from the University of Buenos Aires, where she practiced medicine for a decade. Then she just recently, in the last few years, has earned a doctorate degree in sociology at the University of California, Santa Cruz, where she currently teaches comparative health policy. She's written about diabetes and about healthcare systems, co-authored books on nutrition from general public, giving presentations on these topics in Argentina, in the United States, and in Europe. She's going to be speaking about the Taiwanese healthcare system. It's a hot topic now for these in this field. And we're probably, 5 minutes just won't do that topic justice. We're probably going to have her give a full class or two on this, or maybe a whole bunch of classes on different healthcare and different areas, because that's her specialty. But for now, here we go on Taiwan. Why are we talking about Taiwan?
Thank you, Don. Well, thank you all for being here. And that's a very good question, actually. Why are we talking about Taiwan? What interest could we have in the United States about a small island off the coast of mainland China with barely 23 million people? Well, I think that the case of Taiwan teaches us a couple of very important lessons. Number one, that talking about single-payer HR 676, SB 840, etc., or in other words, to put it in broader terms, a social health insurance system, we do not have to reinvent the wheel. It's been done elsewhere, and it's been done successfully. The case of Taiwan allows us to see that we don't need rocket science in order to resolve our healthcare problems and current crises. So I'm going to save for the longer lesson a little bit of the historical, geographical, and political issues interesting about Taiwan. Let me just say that, give you as a background, that up to 1995, healthcare in Taiwan was organized around a patchwork of some 10 social insurance funds. And I want to emphasize that these were social insurance funds, right? They were not private insurance funds. At any rate, it was a patchwork, and it only covered a little over 55% of the population, which means, conversely, that over 40%, 45% of the population lacked health insurance. So the goal, and that was up to 1995, barely 15 years ago. The goal of Taiwan's reform plan was to, and I quote from some of their documents, let me just add that I'm bringing this also as my colleagues and friends here from the meeting, annual meeting of Physicians for National Health Program, where there was an expert in Taiwan healthcare system, Dr. Mei Chen, who also wrote several papers and published them in a major leading health policy journal, Health Affairs, right? So I'm drawing the information from there. So the goal of the reform plan in Taiwan was to provide access to health care, to comprehensive health care, regardless of ability to pay. The first thing they came up with was a very clear statement of their goal. So after 1995, a decade-long planning effort, Taiwan replaced 10 previously separate funds with a one single-payer national health insurance scheme, social insurance, administered by an agency dependent on the Department of Health. Taiwan has, unlike us, the Department of Health. So the decision was based on an analysis of the healthcare system of over 10 nations. They went around looking and shopping for good ideas, over 10 industrialized, wealthy nations, including us, the United States. The final product they described as a domestically designed and produced car with many components imported from 10 other countries, close quote. Now, fundamental to the idea of this reform plan was an egalitarian system based on the principle of solidarity that considered healthcare as a social good, therefore considered that people deserve a social right to health care. So, of course, you don't send people around to shop. You don't sell them to shop around for social rights. You grant them to them, and that's what the program intended. It drew heavily from Canada and from Germany, both of which have healthcare systems based very specifically, clearly, explicitly, on the principle of solidarity. Just for the record, the German healthcare system goes back to the 19th century. Late 19th century, 1883, was founded by, it was created or pushed by Otto von Bismarck, was the first chancellor of the German Empire, therefore not a socialist, not a communist. In fact, what he wanted to do was prevent the rise of socialism. And it looks like creating the seeds, sowing the seeds of the first social insurance program, and the seeds of the first social health insurance program helped him very well. So back to the Taiwan system. Well, they decided that the funding was going to be public, government finance system, but they didn't touch the delivery. The delivery remained largely private. At the moment, the system is comprehensive. This is exactly what HR 676 intends to do. In their system, of course, given cultural specificities, also includes Chinese medicine. But again, it includes inpatient, outpatient, visual, dental, mental health services, medication, including some non-prescription drugs, some home health care, and so forth. Because when you study anatomy and physiology, you see that the human body is not necessarily compartmentalized between, you know, the eyes on one hand, the teeth on the other hand, and, you know, your physical body, your mind, and so forth, as we do. So this is really comprehensive. So almost overnight, you know, with a span of a year, coverage went up from being 55% to 96% and lately to 99%. And they have inferred that the people who are not covered are just, you know, simply sort of living abroad or just not there. Now, they had some financial strains because of increased utilization by the year 2002. Now, when the Dr. Cheng mentioned the financial straits, it was interesting to me because she said, we were spending 3% of our gross domestic product. And I thought, well, I wish we had that problem, right? It was 17%, millions and millions, a third of the population, either uninsured or underinsured, right? So they, bit by bit, because the system is funded by taxes, yes, the key word, taxes, and premiums, collected as a percentage of income of 4.25%. And you heard well, it's 4.25%. Now they raise it to 4.55%, but they had to struggle for that because people were complaining very strongly. So they were in deficit. Now they're kind of, you know, they have these hurdles to go over, but they're only spending a little over 6% of their gross domestic product is spent collectively on healthcare expenses, right? And covers virtually 100% of the population. So let me repeat the financing. It's a mix of general revenues, income-related contributions, administered by a public fund, publicly accountable, and providers are private and send their bills over there. There are small co-payments, and my understanding is that at least in the beginning, HR 676 would not have them. They waive those co-payments, but they have problems, because in order to decide whether you are poor enough to be waived the co-payment, they have to put administrative apparatus that also costs money. So they're struggling with that, what to do. Now, critical to the success of this plan was the fact that they used global budgets to pay hospital expenses, right? So the global budget was critical to control the rising costs of health care. Not health insurance, but health care. It increased enormously the purchasing power of the public, of the Taiwanese people as a nation, vis-a-vis providers. And this is a feature of economies of scale that you can read in any books on economics, right? You pool everybody's monies together. You have a lot of power when you go out and buy whatever you want to buy. Healthcare is no exception. That's also called monopsony power. That's what single payer means. It's a single purchaser. The delivery is private, almost fully. They have no gatekeepers because Taiwanese people didn't want to have gatekeepers. They have to go through a primary care provider. Now, as a physician, I would, you know, think that that's not desirable. That's one of the problems they're dealing with because people go, for instance, in fact, they have a rate of seeing physicians of almost 15 visits per year per patient. Just to give you a sense of comparison, we have under 5 point something. Right? But they still, you know, provide health care for everybody. So, huge gains. Now everybody's covered. Prices are controlled. Prices are very, much, much lower. They've gone down even for those services that the National Health Program does not cover because it exerts like a pressure over the whole market. Another important thing is that they could streamline all the patient's information, tracking the kinds of problems, clinical problems people have. And when they had the technology available in the year 2002, almost overnight, they brought electronic medical records. Now, they wouldn't have dreamt for a moment to resolve their healthcare problems with electronic medical records, as some people want us to believe. That was a result rather than the way they resolved their health problems. When the system, the financing was in place, bringing in electronic medical records was a no-brainer. And that dramatically decreased their administrative costs even further. A couple of interesting details is that they have a parliamentary system, so that may have allowed a little bit more, you know, pressure from the people, you know, putting on their legislators. At any rate, I think that there are several lessons for the United States. Taiwan, this doctor, this specialist, talked about this. How did they take this bold step of almost overnight bringing a single-payer system? Well, there was a window of opportunity in the country, and it consists of several things, some of which we share and some of which we don't. We do not share their budget surplus. They had a surplus, and they thought, we want to use it for that reason, not to cut taxes for the wealthy. Right? Now, that was a decision, and they made, obviously, given the results, a right step. But let me just point out that if you look at the history of other systems, they have brought about their social insurance reform in moments of their history where they, the countries were in shambles. And a case in point is Great Britain. It was right after World War II, when the country was in shambles and poverty rates were rampant, that Britain brought about the National Health Services. So we've got a lesson to draw from there. Second, what did Taiwan take advantage of? Well, there were political struggles between the incumbent party and the opposition. The opposition was very vocally supportive of a right for health care, a real right to health care. So the incumbent party wanted to be no less and wanted to keep their sons in power, and they brought about the system. Guess what happened? They remained. They were voted again. That was another window of opportunity, and I think we can draw a lesson from that. Now, the third and probably most important feature that we can draw lessons from is that there was strong public support for this system. And believe me, I got the impression that the Taiwanese people really made themselves heard. They really got their politicians to listen to them. And I think that is the key feature of the window of opportunity that Taiwan used to bring about single payer that we can learn from for ourselves. And that's the end of my presentation. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Claudia. You'll see her name pop up some more in our newsletters this whole, you know, evenings and classes and these different things. Our last speaker is Bill Tarrant, who's a doctor of polyethic medicine. And he'll be wrapping up on building the movement after the elections, and to help kick off our discussion. He'll lead off what was discussed at the convention. Bill?
First of all, I'd like to say I wasn't shot. My pen leaked in my pocket. I'm okay. I will talk a little bit about what happened at the Physicians for National Health Payer Convention, but I also add some remarks that I think are pertinent to what's happening maybe after the election. At the convention, there were four speakers on this topic, one representing the Presbyterian Church, the other the California Nurses Association, and then there was someone from the American Medical Students Association, and Oliver Fine, who's the next president for our organization, the Physicians for National Health Program. And naturally, all of them are for single payer, where the Presbyterian Church saw it as a moral imperative to back a system in which everybody has health care, regardless of age status or health care status or economic status. And that was pretty obvious. And he hoped that that movement will kind of spread to the other denominations as well, such as Unitarian. Thank you, Unitarian.
The UL legislative ministry is one of the main things.
Okay. Good. They've always been on our side. United Jewish, United Reform Jewish Movement as well, Union of Reform Judaism, and Catholic Health Association. Hopefully they will come around as well. So that was on the kind of the religious front. You heard a little bit about the American Medical Student Association. I should tell you that the American Medical Association only represents maybe about 17% of medical doctors, yet they're still the voice of the physicians in this country. When you see programs on the national media about healthcare, where the American Medical Student Association, they seem to be a lot more progressive, a lot more in front of the curve, and this is very important that our young doctors coming out today in medical school, osteopathic school, podiatry school, will be indoctrinated with the benefits of a single-payer health care system. And then a speaker, Michael Lightly, who's the public administration director, public affairs director for the California Nurses Association, spoke very highly in favor of single-payer and trying to spread the movement, not just from the California Nurses Association, but to the American Nurses Association, which right now has not taken that leap. And Oliver Fine spoke as well. And he emphasized the importance of congressional legislative visits, very important, if you're ever in Washington, D.C., or the area, grand rounds for doctors, conferences, and op-eds in the newspaper. I'd like to add a couple things. One is, in 2003, Barack Obama stated very clearly at the AFL-CIO convention that he is for single-payer, and all it takes is to win back the White House, the House, and the Senate. And you can watch that on YouTube, by the way, if you want to see that actual talk. There was some talk at the conference also, changing the name from single payer. Maybe it's worn out. Maybe people are getting a little tired from it. Maybe you should call it National Health Insurance, or maybe Medicare for All. What's wrong with Medicare? You might not know this, but already the government provides about 50% of health care in this country through Medicare, Medicaid, the VNA, county hospitals, community clinics. 50% already, so why not take that leap? If we did nothing, what would happen? Well, maybe the system's already imploding. General Motors, you know General Motors, that's the company that provides healthcare by manufacturing automobiles, already having very difficult, not competing on the global market because of the healthcare cost. And there, you would think an employer would be interested in having healthy workers and having their company be able to compete in the world market like other Western civilizations, because they don't have to worry about providing health care costs to their workers, which is escalating. If we did nothing, maybe GDP, health care would become 20% of the gross domestic product. Is that what it takes before we get health care reform? So, in my mind, there are a few things that need to be done in terms of building the movement. One, employers have to be convinced that a single-payer system is the best way to go for their business. And this is being done through talks by members of AMSA and our organization, through Rotary Clubs and small businesses right now, to infiltrate that area that providing health care cost is too much of a burden for them. You see it in prices around markets here in San Francisco. I've seen, in fact, signs at the market on Market Street in the Castro that said, we're sorry about some of our increasing prices, but we had to do this because we have to provide health care for our employees, which is the right thing to do, but it's a very expensive and inefficient system to do it in. Religious groups I already talked about. Maybe AMA, the American Medical Association, will come around and seeing that a multi-payer financing system is not fair or the right way to go. The CMA, I know personally, is working on a lawsuit to expose the insurance companies as being an oligopoly, too few insurance companies controlling the cost. That might be for very selfish reasons, and the CMA trying to get some more reimbursement to their medical doctors, but it's also another thing that might be very bad publicity for the health insurers. We have to get more organizations. There's already a major medical organization that does support single pay right now. It's the American College of Physicians, and they have 125,000 members. The American Public Health Association, of course, supports single payer as well. We also have to get to lawmakers Edward Kennedy, you'll hear more about this next week, but Senator Kennedy is coming out with a health care proposal. His main man for that is the Michael Myers, who's the staff director of Kennedy's Health, Education, Labor, and Pension Committee. And it's important that single-payer health care advocacy organizations get to the table in that discussion. Also, the chairman of the Senate Finance Committee, Matt Backus, will be coming out with some proposals as well. He's the Democrat from Montana. As you know, Barack Obama hired his chief of staff in Rahm Emanuel. His brother, Ezekiel Emanuel, is a prominent doctor, oncologist in Chicago, and he has written articles. You can look at one on the Huffington Post regarding his health care reform, whether he'll have influence on his brother, that will have influence on the president. We don't know, but he's very much in favor of universal health care, but it's through a voucher system, another system that's incremental reform that has proven not to work. So that's Ezekiel Emanuel, Rahm Emanuel's brother. So what we could do to build the movement is the same thing we've been doing to build it to this point right now. Town hall meetings such as this, convincing city councils like they have in Santa Cruz and Marin County that single-payer is the best way to go, and organizing a letter-writing campaign, getting media to event, writing articles to newspapers, not always the Examiner and the Chronicle, but if you happen to be in another city or small town somewhere, anywhere in this country, writing a letter to that, saying you're from San Francisco. A lot of times they see that, and that's interesting to them, and it gets in the paper. We have to lobby organizations such as unions who are still not for us, and local businesses, and of course lobbying medical professionals, teachers and nurses have a lot of pull with the general public, and they already, most of them already support us. I will say to you, don't underestimate the grassroots movement. If you have a healthcare story, and I think if I ask today if anybody has a negative healthcare story in which finance was difficult or someone didn't get care, everybody raise their hand. Everybody knows someone who has a negative healthcare story. Tell those stories to organizations that want to hear them. This is really fuel that will go in for changing healthcare. Thank you very much.